This is Brian Kaplowitz, and you're listening to the Speaker Match Radio Series, Success Strategies for Speakers from the Pros. This is a live show where we interview top experts in the speaking industry and business to provide emerging speakers with marketing strategies and other business building advice. If you're listening live, you can participate in this call online right now by going to speakermatch.com/radio. Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Brian Kaplowitz, your host. And today I will be joined by Jim Muehlhausen, and he is our guest on today's show. He's going to be speaking to us about business models for speakers. Now, Jim has quite an eclectic background, ranging from CPA, franchisee, attorney, business owner, consultant, franchisor, public speaker, university professor, and book author. And as the founder of the Business Model Institute and the author of Business Models for Dummies, combined with Jim's experience as a professional speaker, we should hear some nuances about the topic of business models that we might not hear elsewhere. And this topic is a first for this program. And I'm looking forward to hear what Jim has to share. Welcome, Jim. It's great to have you with us today.
I appreciate it, Brian. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you with us. So, like I said, today's topic is business models for speakers. You're going to be talking about maximizing income through smart work versus hard work. I really like that topic.
Yeah, it's a tricky topic in the world of speaking, isn't it?
Well, it can be, and I think that a lot of people that come into the speaking business don't really understand what's involved in building a business, especially a sustainable speaking business. So that is, I think, very helpful for people to hear how they might be able to keep things going for them. A lot of people get off on the wrong track, and it can be hard to get back on the right track. So what is the background to writing Business Models for Dummies?
A lot of working with business owners. And so, you know, my typical client owns a $2 to $50 million business. And you start seeing a bunch of different variety in performance and a bunch of different personality types, education levels, you name it. And I saw far too many well-educated, smart, hardworking people working really hard for not a tremendous amount of results. And then on the flip side, I saw people that maybe weren't quite so smart, weren't quite so hardworking, but were making money hand over fist, and it didn't correlate. You go, how can hard work and smarts and talent not correlate to the same results as someone that doesn't have it? And you start digging around and looking for answers, and what you come up with is, it's the business model. You know, I always joke, let me run Google, I can't screw it up. You know, that they've got such a good model that even I couldn't mess up Google for several years. And that's the power of a great business model, that a great business is built upon the foundation of a great business model.
So you use the term business model, and I'm not sure that everybody knows exactly what that means. How do you define that? What is a business model?
A lot of different ways. I mean, it's kind of art and not science. So at its most simple level, it's, you know, what's the formula by which you're going to acquire customers, service them, and profit from them? Or you could say, how do you make money? We kind of break it into eight areas and three bigger ones. So we talk about what you're offering. In the case of speaking, you could offer a lot of things, but almost everybody offers speaking services for a variety of prices. How are you going to monetize that? I think that's probably the topic we'll talk about the most today, is monetization of speaking and peripheral services. And then how will you sustain it? That's another tricky issue for speaking, in that if I don't jump on an airplane and go give a speech, I don't get paid.
So is a business model having systems in place? Is it a little bit more than that?
Well, I think that if we talk about it from the perspective of, say, a business plan, to me, you have this business model where we're going to sell widgets or we're going to write applications for Android system. And then the business plan talks about how we're going to execute the business model. So to me, when we're talking about the business model, we're talking about, you know, what is the plan for services, to what extent we will monetize those. And so I would contend that a lot of speakers have a business model that could be improved in that they simply are trying to sell their time for money. I go out, I market speeches, I go do a speech, I get paid for a speech, and then I want to go get another one. Selling their time
for
money.
So, and that's pretty it. At its most basic level, that's what most speakers are doing. They're trying to figure out how to sell their time for money. What else should be incorporated into a speaker business model?
Well, the tough question I would like the speakers listening to ask themselves, I think, you know, and I do it too. And I go, oh, goody, I'm going to make, you know, X amount of money just for doing this hour and a half long speech. And I convince myself what a rocket scientist I am and how incredibly awesome I am to get that amount of money for that little time. And I forget about the airplane ride, and I forget about the hand-holding that I had to do ahead of time to get them to pay me. And then occasionally I'll forget about my rep fee and all of that. And you start going, you know, you start subtracting that some days it, or sometimes it takes 2 days to do one-hour speech if you don't have a back-to-back, that rate gets significantly lowered. And so I would encourage everyone listening to really think about how much you make from a speech if you start taking everything into account. The sales cost, the time it takes chasing the gig, the travel time, the recoup time. I come back and sometimes I'm kind of wiped out and I'm not ready to reload and go do it, and I kind of have an unproductive day the day after. A long day of travel sometimes. So if I have a worst case scenario where it took me 3 days to do one speech, and then I have all of the sales time, that rate is not within my goal. So if I say I want to make $500,000 a year or $1 million a year, and to me, you know, everyone listening should have a goal to make $1 million a year in the speaking business, you've got to generate $1,000 an hour every hour that you're working if you follow the model that you're working half the time and not working the other half. Well, that's a pretty significant rate, and under my three-day story, I probably didn't make $1,000 an hour, which means I've got to find a way to bump that rate up.
Now, how did you come up with $1 million a year for every speaker?
Well, why not? Should I pick a different number? Not every speaker. It's a lot like Hollywood, isn't it? I mean, you know, one of the people that has the same rep as me gets $35,000 a speech, plus. I think he got $25,000 for taping something in a motel room and broadcasting it. You know, if you can get that, then you're in great shape. But I'm guessing that 90% of the people listening are not getting $35,000 a speech.
So are you saying that people should build a model with an expectation? So for a speaker, building a model with an expectation for a plan to make $1 million a year?
Whatever they think a number of a good amount of money is, I'm sure there are plenty of people that $500,000 would do it or $300,000 would do it. But A, you know, stuff happens. So if I say, well, you know, I could make it on $350, that'd be great. Well, you better just call that $450 just in case. But you need to devise a business model that can generate, let's just call it $500,000 to keep the math simple, $500,000 a year. And for most people, just speaking isn't going to do that. So to me, if you want to say devise a great business model for a speaker, I think the first thing you do is you say that speaking is nothing more than a paid sales call. That's why speaking is such a great model. If you really do speaking right, you're actually getting paid to sell people stuff. There's not a whole lot of businesses like that, you know, to where you get paid to go on sales calls. But speaking is one of them. The problem is if all you do is paid sales calls, you really don't make a ton of money. Unless you're one of the elite, much like a Hollywood A-lister. You know, they can get paid to show up and wear somebody's jewelry. You and I, probably not so much.
So you've been in the speaking business for how long now?
Oh, probably 5 or 6 years.
Okay, so for a little while, what kinds of things have you seen speakers incorporating into their business model that help them to get to that place where they can be on stage regularly in front of an audience generating the kind of income they want?
Well, the first thing is to think about, like I said, that if you think about, well, I'm up there and it's a sales call, then, for instance, I use this model I call gasoline, cigarettes, and soda. And the concept is that gasoline stations cost $4 or $5 million to build, and they probably lose money depending on how you account for it selling gasoline. But the gasoline is the customer acquisition vehicle. And if you don't have gas, you don't sell candy bars, soda, water, et cetera, where you do make your money. So if you don't have a convenience store with your gas station, that's a bad business model, and it typically is a bad business model. And so the first thing you got to think about is, what can I make money on that better leverages my time? Because we all run out of that resource. And so unless we're going to get $1,000 an hour, which can be difficult to get if you're not an A-lister, how do you generate $500 or $1,000 an hour? Well, you do it with leverage.
Okay. And what are some of those types of things that you've seen people doing that are helping them get to that goal?
Well, there's all the typical ones that you hear. So certainly things like selling customers not one at a time. So things like webinars and teleseminars and recorded courses and a book is leverage. I mean, if you could sell enough books, I wrote a book called The 51 Fatal Business Errors that's now pushing 6 years old, and it still sells very well. That thing will probably be selling when I'm 6 feet under. It's a timeless book. I was lucky enough to write a timeless book, and it still sells enough to make enough money to buy something every now and then. So those are terrific. The other thing is how, and this is tricky. This is very tricky to do, and most people have a hard time executing this, including it's not always easy for me. It's why I created the Business Model Institute, that by having an institute, I now have the option to sell my time if they want to pay a lot of money, or I can have people that I have certified. So, for instance, we have a program called the Certified Business Model Analyst, and we certify the knowledge in business models, and then we create a piece of software, which is another piece of leverage. You put your time into writing the software, and then you stamp out lots of copies of the software so that other people can pay us to use our toolkit, or other people can, you know, leverage the certification to help grow their practice. So if you have something that you could turn into, I'll call it a program, whether that be a computer program or a training program or something along those lines, you have the opportunity to have someone else put in their time instead of you.
If you are just joining us, we are speaking with Jim Muehlhausen, and he is talking to us about building a successful business model, specifically for speakers. If you would like to ask a question of Jim, you can go online to speakermatch.com/radio and enter your question in the form that you see on the webpage there. Or if you have dialed in live, you can dial *2 to raise your virtual hand, and that will let me know that you have a question so that I can bring you into our call. Jim, we have a question that was submitted by Dawn in Las Vegas. She wants to know how she can evaluate whether or not she is charging enough for her speaking service.
Well, you could use the old axiom that if someone doesn't say it's too expensive, it's not. I mean, that's probably, believe it or not, that's probably the most accurate way. Raise your price and see if people still pay you. If they don't, you had it priced right.
Okay.
You know, the other thing is to do some benchmarking. It's going to depend on a lot of things, and this is really outside my area of expertise. This is where speakers reps come in, is, you know, what is a similar speaker charging? What is the demand for your topic? And I'm sure that people that were Twitter experts or social media experts 5 or 6 years ago were commanding a lot higher prices than they are now because there's so many more experts today than there was.
Okay. So let's get back to, I guess, your area that's maybe a little bit more in your area of expertise. When you're talking about a business creating a money-making business or building a money-making business, what kinds of elements do you need to be looking at putting into that? Well, I guess we'll focus on the speaking business. What kinds of things should you think about putting into your business to generate some streams of income?
Well, I think the first thing that you could think about is if you think about the speech as a paid sales call. And don't interpret that the wrong way. Just because something is a paid sales call doesn't mean that the audience can't get value from it. You know, Tony Robbins, all these big speakers do it all the time. If you look at the speaking sheets where these high-paid $50,000 speakers are bringing in engagements, one of the questions that they ask is, can I sell from the podium? And if you say absolutely not, you cannot, you know, offer anything to the audience from the podium, they're going to charge you more than if you allow people to buy something. And so I think that there's a fine line that talented speakers can execute between selling from the podium and having the audience that you know you are selling from the podium and giving the audience an opportunity to get more from you if they like what you're saying. And I think A is out of bounds and B is not.
Okay, so there are lots of things that I've seen speakers incorporate into their business. I'm wondering if you can give us an idea about some of the things that you think might work better than others as far as building a sustainable, successful business model. So, for example, having a book or a consulting service on the back end, a newsletter. Are there certain things that you think speakers should be paying a little more attention to?
I have no benefit in saying this, but I think every speaker should have a book. Even if it's just, there's a huge trend right now going on towards creating just an Amazon Kindle book only, so that you save the headache of publishing a paper book, because it's a lot more work to do a paper book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's relatively painless for people that have good content, and I'll assume that every speaker has something interesting to say. A book
mm-hmm.
gives you a tremendous amount of credibility and is going to, if it doesn't raise your pricing, which it should, because when I wrote the Dummies book, I raised my pricing significantly. Now I've written two books instead of one, and you can charge more just because you wrote a book. Even if it doesn't allow you to raise your prices, it certainly is going to increase your expert power. So
okay,
that would be the first one I would recommend.
You have more on that list?
Oh, sure. Any kind of products, and I think you need to keep in mind who your audience is. So, for instance, I don't sell a lot to someone thinking about starting a business. My crowd has a business, and that particular crowd of $2 to $50 million business owners does not buy a lot of Internet courses. I always joke, they're not out there Googling, how can I become a better leader? Some of them are, but the bulk of them are busy running their business, and they're not looking for an Internet course. And so that's been a point of contention for me, because I'd love to create a bunch of courses. I've got some really good content, but the adoption rates on those are much less than someone that sells to, say, groups of MLMs or someone that sells to people thinking about starting a business. Those people do consume Internet courses. It just has to be priced right. You wouldn't want to sell an Internet course for $399 to that crowd. $39 is a more interesting price tag.
Okay, so when you're putting together a business model, what kinds of things do you need to be thinking about so that you are building a model that lasts for a while? So, or maybe I should ask, how often do you have to revisit your model?
Well, you should probably look at it. I recommend annually. It just depends. The problem is the world changes on you. All you got to do is look at BlackBerry. That was the most valuable company in Canada not that long ago, and now they may not make it, or they may sell them off for the patent rights. Things change, even if you're not in technology, and you're going to want to modify how you go at the market every so often, because there's this human need, and I have it too, that I want to build something, and I want to work really hard to build it, and then I want to sit back and I want to enjoy the benefits of my labor. And the last thing I want to do is change it once I get it working. The problem is the world doesn't let you do that. So every year you should look at it.
And do you have a system that you recommend for grading or judging the success of your business model?
Well, yeah, I'm really biased. I've got two of them. In the book, we throw out a concept called the business model wheel, and you can download it on my website. You can actually just go to businessmodelwheel.com, and you can download the graphic, and it breaks the business model into eight areas, scores each area, and you can just self-score it. So that's kind of a quick and dirty way to at least look at your business model in more than a, hey, I think it's pretty good, on the back of a napkin. We have a more sophisticated piece of software that I was alluding to before called the business quotient, the BQ, and we use a very sophisticated several hundred factors where a certified business model analyst goes in, looks at a business, and then scores a business model from 0 to 100, much like a FICO score scores your creditworthiness.
Okay. And is there something that you that you recommend that people be looking for to make sure that it is as effective as before when they're coming up with when they you grade your business model, you figure out where you're at, you come up with some changes. Do you have a way to better judge that your new model is going to be at least as effective as it was before?
Well, to some extent, you've got to rely on the market for that. I even put a graph in the book about, you know, how many people think your idea is great in relation to how likely it is going to be great. Almost every great idea, lots of people thought was horrible. You know, no one ever asked for an ATM. No one ever asked for a smartphone. Someone was gutsy enough to put an ATM out there and assume you wanted to deal with a robot, not a person at the bank, and then it got accepted. You know, Blockbuster had a chance to buy Redbox for $60 million, but they thought it was a stupid idea. Why would anybody want to get their DVDs in the mail? These are smart people. I mean, these people had 80% of the market, and they dismissed, what was going to be the leading technology as a fluke, because in the front view mirror, it looks a lot different than in the rear view mirror. So, cheap, fast failure with upside is what I recommend. I want to fail fast. I want to fail cheaply. And I want to gamble my business on what I think might work. And I want it to have upside. You know, can it hurt? Can it help? If I'm going to try something, but I might lose 10 speaking engagements if I try, probably shouldn't try that one. But like the woman that wanted to do something with her pricing, how about the next three that come in, bump the price a grand or two and see what people say?
Susan from Dallas has a question. She would like you to explain the difference between a business plan and a business model. She's not quite clear on that.
We feel that a business model should be incorporated into the business plan. I mean, the business model at its simplest thing is this is the formula by which we're going to make money. So, for instance, even if you look at Starbucks' business model over the last several years, that business model's changed a lot. They used to be coffee shops. They made money by opening up more coffee shops and selling you coffee. Well, now they're getting into grocery stores and they're selling you CDs and they're extending this lifestyle brand. Their business model has changed to more of the Starbucks way of life, and oh, by the way, it has coffee, than it used to be just buying and selling coffee. And so the business plan to me shows how you're going to execute the business model. Who are we going to hire? What's the financials look like from the business model? There's really a very light financial dealing in the business model, maybe touching upon, you know, good margin or bad margin. You know, I have a client that sells a very, very funky polymer product that has margins over 90% on some of their products. At some point it gets, okay, got it. You make terrific margins. Who cares whether it's 87.2 or 91.3? In the business plan, that matters because you've got to lay out the financials. In a business model, it's a really high margin product. Now what?
You talk about working smart versus working hard. Can you explain how that applies to a business model for a speaker?
Sure. We're back to that selling time for money. To me, working smart in a speaker's business model is how do you monetize things that indirectly take your time, use someone else's time that is not yours, or sell products, or leverage your time like a group product. So, for instance, we do a big once a year, you know, we lovingly call it the circus, where, you know, we'll go to Vegas or Chicago and do a business model expo. And people that have an interest in doing that will pay a pretty good chunk of money to do that. And it certainly takes my time to put that on. But I have lots of other people that can help put that on. But the people that participate in that are driven by my speaking.
Okay. You have any other examples of working smart versus working hard that might help some of our speakers?
Absolutely, but I'm going to come at it from a different angle. I'm a contrarian at heart. I'll ask a question to the audience, and that is, if I made you, or you had to, you know, gun to your head, had to hire a smart woman or man to be on your staff for, let's call it, $75,000 a year. Not a ton of money, but you can expect somebody with reasonable smarts that is going to just help you grow your speaking business. And so for someone that has a speaking business that isn't producing the income they want, that's quite a burden. But what I want them to think about is, how would you not only pay for that person $75,000 on staff, but how would you make more money as a result of them being there? And I think that if you'll go through that exercise and really think about it, you will come up with some answers that are along the lines of what I'm saying, and you'll figure out how that person could better leverage you and not just get you more speaking gigs. Yes, you can do that, but that's not the answer. It's got to be more than that.
So we've often heard people say that a speaker wants to be out there speaking, and most people that are speaking are not particularly skilled at running the back office. It's often not their thing. So it may make sense to hire a staff or have a virtual assistant or something like that to help you out. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Not exactly. I mean, that could be part of what I'm talking about. I mean, we'll call that stripping away the administrative time so I can redeploy my time for better use. Okay, that's good leverage. That's good leverage. But what I'm more driving at with that example is, what additional revenue streams would you create that don't require your time? Yeah, I'm going to make you spend $75,000 so that you can go create new revenue streams that you don't currently have. What would they be? How would you go about doing it? How would you minimize your time input into that? You know, back to my business model expo. That doesn't take much of my time other than masterminding it and showing up at it. The rest of it can be done by other people, but it's still got my smiling face attached to it.
Okay. Are there any warning signs that people should look for that they may need to adapt their business model or change to new conditions?
I think that, you know, this is always tough when you're in it. When it gets harder, I mean, that is a classic sign. And the problem is, you know, we've got that boiling your frog thing going on where the water's only rising 1 degree every now and then, and it just feels a little bit hotter. Is if you're continuing to work harder for the same or marginally better results, that's to me when you look at your business model. Because at the fundamental question of any business is, do I have the right business model that justifies me putting my time, energy, and life into, or am I better off to put my efforts into something that is modified? And so when it starts to feel like it's too hard, you're probably right.
Now, one of the strengths that you described for having a business model is its power for innovation. Why is the business model so great for innovation?
I think because it makes you think about the categories. To me, if all of a sudden you're not going, well, how do I make money? Well, I go speak more and I get paid to do it. Okay, but if I make you go, well, what market are you in? So, for instance, a colleague of mine is down in Louisiana, and he had a really cool product that was for managers, and it was a series of training, we'll call it, for managers, and it was not working to his satisfaction. We had a conversation. We talked about it from a business model perspective, and we talked in particular about area number one of the model, which is we call market attractiveness. That's broken down into what is the industry, what is the niche, and who are the customers, and then there's a bunch of sub-factors from that. But those are the big ones. And so he started looking at the fact that he's in oil and gas and chemical country, and he literally took the exact same products he had, tailored them for the oil and gas business, and started calling it XYZ for oil and gas. And it went from nobody will buy this to now people are calling him, and he's spending more time in Houston than he is in Louisiana because they can't get enough of this, oil and gas specific industry. That's a very simple change, but a lot of people are afraid to narrowly focus like that, and because they are afraid to focus, they don't have what I call a sharp spear. It's not sharp enough to penetrate anything, and effectively, it's boring in the marketplace.
It can be scary to innovate, especially if you have a business model that is generating some income, maybe even more importantly, is an income that is just what you need. It can be kind of scary to change things and innovate when you're not so certain about what that outcome might be. You may have some good ideas, but how do you go about beginning that innovation process and getting comfortable enough with your idea so that you can move forward and actually begin to innovate?
You can do several things. The first thing is back to gasoline, cigarettes, and soda. If you look at it through the lens of you're stuck selling gasoline in order to sell the things that you want to sell, the bottled water, the soda, the candy bars, the things you make good money on. Cigarettes are ridiculous money makers. Nobody wants to sell, but I assure you, nobody in the gas business wants to sell gas. It's cumbersome, painful, and not profitable. But you have to have it. And so in our case, in Speaker's case, the gasoline really is the speaking, if you do it right. The gasoline is the speaking. It's the least profitable thing you do. And so the mistake that I see people make is they try to figure out how to sell more gas. It's like you don't need or want to sell more gas if you don't have to. What you want to sell is more of the other stuff. So if I were going to experiment, what I would figure out is figure out something that you make double the rate per hour that you do on your speaking. Triple, quadruple would be better, but at least double what you make there and do a small experiment, you know, cheap, fast failure with upside.
So something like having an additional product that you sell or something?
Well, my first experiment would be if you don't have a book, write an e-book. And yes, I know you hate writing. So do I. I've written two books. I hate writing. I was never good at English. I got my way through it. Suck it up.
Have you found that if you have an e-book to sell, that there's any difference in the types of sales or numbers of sales that you get versus having a physical product that people can hold on to when they're in the room and you're speaking?
Yes, there's a big difference. I mean, the fact is it is quicker and easier to do an e-book than it is to do a hardcover. And there are significant benefits of a hardcover book. I'll speak for myself. I sell more e-books than I do hardcover books. But notice I have hardcover books, and, well, A. Wiley's going to make sure we have a hardcover book for the Dummies book. That's not my choice. It's theirs. But a hardcover book that you can prop up at the back of the room, I mean, it's difficult to get your head around intangibles. You know, they're called intangibles for a reason. So to me, I'm a pragmatist. If you don't have a book and you write an e-book, you're now an author, and I assure you that will help your business. So to me, it's go from non-author to author in the easiest way possible. If you want to do it right, take the extra step and do a hardcover book because you'll get a lot more credit for a hardcover book, whether anybody buys it or not.
You're talking about innovation, and I've heard a little bit about disruptive innovation. Can you talk about what that is and how that applies to fitting it into your business model?
Yeah, and I think that we can look at some of the things in speaking that have been potentially disruptive to speaking. And, you know, this is all based upon the work of Clayton Christensen, the Harvard professor, and I strongly recommend that everyone listening read all of his books because they're terrific. But there's three on disruptive innovation, the startup point being the innovator's dilemma, Clayton Christensen with E's, not A's or I's. But in speaking, think about what technology has done. You know, it used to be that if people wanted to get ideas from traveling experts, they had to leave their office, and then they had to go down to the conference center, and then they had to see somebody speak. And now you have YouTube, and you have teleseminars, and you have webinars, and you have virtual trade shows that are all potentially disruptive to the speaking business. And like any disruptive innovation, those can be both positive and negative, depending on which side of it you're on.
Once again, we are talking to Jim Muehlhausen, and if you have a question for us, you can dial *2 to raise your virtual hand. We do have some questions that were submitted online, Jim. First one is from Roger in Connecticut. His question is, can you describe your support team or staff, and what work do you do, and what work do the other people do? Also, are they full-time, part-time, or stringers?
I use a lot of virtual. I have a huge virtual staff, you know, through places like we just redid the business model website, for instance, and I used a combination. I think we ended up using four different vendors to do it, one to do the video. That was a local company here. We did the web design on CrowdSpring. We had somebody wireframe it from Elance, and then I think we had somebody else involved in that as well. So I have a couple of virtual assistance firms that I use. One is in Israel. One is in India, and they have different strengths. You know, one has kind of an education-based learning, so they could do a lot of Camtasias and PowerPoints and things like that. I do have a full-time assistant that's been with me for a dozen years that does everything from managing the other people to picking up the phone when I don't feel like it is probably her biggest strength. I'm kind of a person where I do much better if I have a scheduled phone call than if I have to actually pick up the phone, so I leverage Sue for that. As far as the support team, I do have a speakers rep, and I rely on her team. She has a fairly big team that does everything from if my website needs a redesign to chasing speaking gigs to telling me how I can become a better speaker. So my speaking agent handles a lot of that, and effectively I leverage her organization and virtual organization for a lot of that. But from a technology point of view, I've got at least a dozen websites, and you know, I prefer to handle those internally, if nothing else, just for cost. I know enough about technology to be dangerous, so I prefer to use what I call a flexible cost structure. I only hire an employee when I really need to hire an employee, because then you end up spending your time figuring out how to keep them busy.
And how many employees do you currently have?
I have two full-time employees that work just for me, and I think the last time I counted, I used about 93 different contractors, depending on whether I need a PowerPoint laid out or a video edited or for you know someone that knows PHP.
Wow, so you have a stable of people that you like to go to that are kind of on standby or available through these different services like Elance or something?
Yeah, I've probably got five people we're using on Elance right now, from everything from you know people to take care of data input for us to I've got a PHP guy that's in India that I'm using quite a bit right now, and I've got a graphics guy that I probably use 30 hours a month for just you know making things pretty. I mean, there's an area that I think has changed a lot because of the internet. You know, before you could put out some fairly ugly stuff. You know, I've been in business since the 80s. You know, in the 80s and 90s, you could put out some very things that today you'd go, ugh, and it was okay back then. But with the internet mm-hmm. and with, you know, graphics, if you don't have a graphics person that you can call upon, and I have several, you know, the, you know, if I need a pie chart, to me, I can't do a pie chart that looks pretty enough, nor do I want to. So I have a great guy that's in you know, one of the Eastern European countries, and they've got some great people in those Eastern Bloc countries do some beautiful graphics, and they're very reasonably priced.
So I've had a lot of people ask how you keep track of or how you have people that are available on a regular basis, because it seems that experience a lot of people have the experience that they find somebody that is good, but then it's a one-time project and they never use them or hear from them again. What do you do to keep track of the people that you really like?
Well, I think I agree with them. I think that it's really tricky to reengage. I had a firm do a beautiful website for a client and just turned the client on to them, and I contacted them last month to fix a WordPress update glitch, and it was like pulling teeth just to get them to help this client, and I had the client end up just starting over with firm number two. So I think my clients' ways of handling that have been more along the lines of sometimes it's easier just to reload. You know, I know you want to go back to the well because you've already vetted them and you've already done that, but it just depends on what it is. I think that my experience is if you can't keep these offshore people busy, you're going to lose them and you're better to start over. And I realize nobody wants to hear that, but I think that that's the reality from what I've seen.
All right. We have a lot of speakers on the line, but nobody is raising their hand. Which is very interesting because speakers don't want to speak. They are submitting questions online, though, so I have some to read. By the way, if you're listening right now live it's a great way to advertise your speaking business because the replays of podcasts are often heard for years and years by very large audiences. You never know who's going to hear you, so just the opportunity to get your name in front of somebody is always good. But we will go on to our written questions. We have a question from Greg in Arkansas. He would like to know if you recommend building a speaking business around a brand name, the speaker's name, or some combination.
That is a great question. And so I'm assuming by a brand name it would be, let's talk about Michael Gerber and the E-Myth. I mean, Gerber has done a good job of building a business that's not contingent upon his speaking anymore. I mean, the E-Myth is a brand. He has an organization of people that do the work that are not him. And his speaking just drives that, and he's even shifted his focus away from promoting the E-Myth onto other interests in his life. But yet the E-Myth organization still exists. So I think that in general, nothing's absolute, you are better off to brand it as a company, we'll call it, versus you. And my speakers rep and I go round and round about this because it's easier to brand you. It's much easier to brand you, but I think you need to decide what you want to do. If you want to make $500 million a year, and you really don't want to go past that point, brand it as you. It'll be easier. It'll be easier, but now you're stuck because nobody else is you.
You know, it's interesting. It reminds me of a story I heard from Gene Simmons of KISS. He was speaking at a marketing conference that I went to, and he talked about building a brand and building his business. And he could have built his band around his name, which was his original idea, but he decided that he wanted to be able to build a business that would last for a lot longer than he could. And it didn't matter who was up there in front of the audience as long as they sounded good, but he sold the whole brand of KISS around that. So it just kind of reminds me of that. It's probably easier to build a long-term, more sustainable business around something that is not necessarily your name.
Yes, and really, you know, the standard if you're a Rob Reiner fan is the Dread Pirate Roberts. You know, the Dread Pirate Roberts wore a mask, and they just kept on changing who the Dread Pirate Roberts was.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly.
And Princess Bride. And so that's ideally, you know, what we want. I actually referenced in my book, if anybody remembers The Rich Jerk, there was a guy on the internet that was schlopping, you know, get rich quick, and his whole thing was The Rich Jerk, and he was a cartoon character. It's genius. I mean, he had the Dread Pirate Roberts thing going. No one even knows who he is. He's a cartoon character.
Interesting. I'm not familiar with that one.
And my branding guy, I've got a genius branding guy that I work with, and he swears that the number one way you can brand something is with an icon or a cartoon. And I thought he was insane when I first met him, but I now know, like, and trust him, and I agree with him now because he's won me over. So you know, the standard is really the Rich Jerk. Now, I'm guessing that most – and notice I don't do that because I haven't been able to pull it off. It's not easy, but it is the right answer.
All right. One last question we have from Roger in Connecticut. He says that you gave an example of a person who focused his offering to the oil and gas industry. What type of product did he or she have?
I'll call it mid-management level training. He had training for people that were in mid-level management in that specific vertical.
All right. So what is the first step that a speaker should take towards adopting a business model? What do they need to do to get started?
Well, look at what they've currently got. I would download the wheel, and again, that's at businessmodelwheel.com. Download the wheel and look at what you currently got. And typically what ends up happening is someone looks at an area and they go, oh, I don't score well there. And then you say, okay, well, A, why are you scoring poorly there? B, what can you do about it? We've talked about several potential ways to do about it. And if you don't have as many speaking gigs as you would like, that's gas, of course, I think you work on two things. One, you work on how can I double the number of engagements that I have? And then in addition, how can I increase that key performance indicator in our business called what is the total economic value of a speech? And if I get paid $5,000 to go do a speech, but I have no additional monetization, it's $5,000 to do that speech. But if I pick up a if I pick up 2.3 consulting gigs and I sell $1,000 of the books at the back of the room and I do whatever, getting that average speaking gig to $15,000 or $20,000 versus five is a huge difference maker in my business model.
All right, Jim. Well, I do appreciate your spending some time with us today. Is there anything else that speakers need to know about building a business model, maintaining a business model, making something work for them?
Well, of course, the single best thing they can do is go buy Business Models for Dummies on Amazon or at their local Barnes & Noble. And I promise it's worth the read because there is quite a bit in there. You know, I love dealing with smart business people like speakers because they can take something that doesn't directly apply to them. And there's nothing in the book that applies to speakers directly. Don't use any examples of speakers. They're all businesses. But if you're a savvy businesswoman or man, you're going to be able to look at that and say, oh, that doesn't fit, but here's how I can twist that. And so I have three chapters on some cool innovation things, including crowdsourcing and some new technology that you can use. And I promise that there's a good idea or two in there. You can learn more about the book at businessmodelbooks.com, businessmodelbooks.com. And then, of course, we've got the Business Model Institute site where we're always trying to post a blog post or two that will help people have a better business, and that's businessmodelinstitute.com.
All right. Well, thank you very much again for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me on, Brian.
All right. Well, our guest today, again, was Jim Muehlhausen, and you can find the replay of this event at speakermatch.com/radio. And if you have any comments or you'd like to make any remarks about today's interview, you can visit us on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. We'd love to hear your thoughts and continue the conversation. You can also find a replay of this call on iTunes. Just search for Speaker Match, that's one word, or visit speakermatch.com/radio and look under the replay section. We're also available on Stitcher Radio, which you can find in your smartphone's app store. Until next time, this is Brian Kaplowitz.
Thanks for listening to this installment of the Speaker Match Radio Series, Success Strategies for Speakers from the Pros. Speaker Match is the leading provider of tools and services for emerging professional speakers. You can find more information about Speaker Match at www.speakermatch.com. Our toll-free number, if you prefer to reach us by phone, is 1-866-372-8768. International callers can reach us at area code 512-372-8768. Thank you again for listening, and we wish you the best in your speaking career.